thing, the quart out. I think I destroyed their system. Broken some eardrums. And even when I have a little unit like this on, I still get nervous. Okay, before we talk about Chronicles, I'm going to open it up and just discuss, if you would like, any of the issues about. Pastor.
I was just thinking, there were a number of sacrifices that humanly offered at the various times, the various kings, various kings. And then there was the washing of clothes from time to time, and the command that you shall be at that time unclean until the evening. And that's repeated over and over. Mm-hmm. I assume it's in Leviticus throughout the probably from Leviticus on. I've never found anywhere, but I'm just wondering if what this means to you. Is there something in the life of the people given to them by God, something sacred then about the going down of the sun? The onset of the evening, because it was for the rest of the day from that point, whether it be in the morning or late in the afternoon, could be 8 or 9 hours, it could be half an hour, until the evening, that you would be unclean, and it was connected with washing, and I assume sacrifice too.
Okay.
Do you have any information on that? I've always been very curious about that, and nothing I've ever read explains what was critical about the going down of the sun to the time of cleansing.
No, I don't have information, but I have some great theories.
Okay.
Trouble with my theories is sometimes that they're too good, they're probably wrong. This is certainly I think true. First connected with the going down the sun, the end of the day. It said a new day then begins, which is directly connected with Genesis 1, and there was morning and there was evening. The day begins and ends. And so that which is past is past. Again, the sacredness of time. And if something is unclean until the sun goes down, it's unclean until the end of that day, then a new day begins in which cleanness takes place, cleansingness. Now, in terms of the washing of clothes, and many of the regulations of the Old Testament, you got to remember what we would call civic law in the Old Testament, regulations about how you cook your food, uncleanness, the women are unclean at certain times in biblical thought, all these other different times of uncleanness for people are all connected with the sacredness of the people. The rabbis have explained it in later rabbinical literature in this way, that God regulates among his people those things which they have in common with the animal world. And things like the two big issues that are regulated are dietary and sexuality. Because all animals eat, all animals reproduce. But God says, you're human beings, you're different than the animals. And so the way in which those things are exercised within the human community is to be differentiated from the natural world that surrounds the human being. Because those things are part and parcel of living in the world. But as God's people, they'd be different than the world. All the issues of uncleanness, including clothing, for example, has to do with a separation from the rest of creation. It's really an extension of creation theology into the lives of the people. Where the creation story itself presents the human being as being created differently than the animal. And so that is to be lived out in the life of God. I don't know if that gets to your...
Just one other question. Totally unrelated to that subject. Did you say at one time, concerning the book of Ecclesiastes, the word gatherer? Did I hear that?
Oh, yeah, Kohelet, yeah, the convener, gatherer.
Ecclesiastes, like
the ecclesia,
called out.
Yeah, see, ecclesia is the, Ecclesiastes comes from the Greek word ecclesia. The Hebrew term is Kohelet. That's the title of the book. It's not equal to Ecclesiastes, the Greek word. It's just the name they gave to the book in the Greek version. It's the the one who calls out. Our English Bibles have picked up the title Ecclesiastes from the Greek translation of the Old Testament, not from the Hebrew, the original Hebrew. It's known as Kohelet, or more of the convener, perhaps the preacher. Yeah. In fact, the King James translates, you know, the preacher says, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. It's a great book to give if somebody's depressed. You know?
You talk about the incorporation of liturgical or sacred time into the daily lives of the people. And we know from medieval times that, you know, there was the effort to have daily prayer, certainly in the lives of the people who were dedicating their lives to the Lord. How would you propose that we incorporate the sense of sacred time today? I mean, what can we do, not necessarily as pastors, but as lay people, to incorporate that real sense of sacred time?
Yeah, I think a good starting point is Luther's catechism. When you rise in the morning, Luther says, the directions for morning prayer, make the sign of the cross and say, when you go to bed in the evening, you know, that morning and evening, and then Luther also includes prayers, meals. There is also, I think, a lot of it for us as Christians in this culture. Yes, I keep talking about culture. I get very nervous when we Christians begin to think about how we can adapt to the culture. Because the Christian faith has always been contrary to culture, regardless of where that culture is. It was true for Paul. It was true in medieval Europe. It's true in other parts of the world. It's certainly true here in this country. Our faith is countercultural. But in the culture, it's very difficult for us to think always in terms of the theological or the spiritual. It's discussed, you know, as I mentioned before, if you think about your day, you kind of separate out certain times during the day in which you've done certain things. And at least at the time, you were probably not self-consciously aware of the sacredness of the act. You know, I can certainly name times. I come home today, my wife says, you get to change the diapers. I've been doing it all day. Okay, fine. You know, take hand up, change your diaper. It did not appear to me to be a sacred moment. But that's because I'm a product of this culture, too, and it's difficult to think in terms of theology. I think a Christian spirituality, which is what we're really getting at here, is not just a matter of individual times of devotion, although those are important. We cannot define our spirituality, as Lutherans in particular, as having being confined to a time of prayer and meditation, Bible reading, whatever. Although that is a vital thing in the Christian life. But rather, the Christian spirituality, the biblical spirituality, I hope that we would strive for, is to see all of life as belonging to God. That every waking moment, every conscious moment, indeed the moments we sleep, are moments which belong to God. So that our devotion or our ordering of time, that we begin to see each event in our lives as reflecting God's presence and God's promises. When the guy cuts you off, yeah, this happened to me a couple days ago. I let a guy out in the parking lot. This can be a nice guy, kind of stopped, let him out. A little while later, I see the guy again, and this time he cuts me off. You know, that from one perspective that was frustrating. From another perspective, that was a theological, a sacred moment. Yeah. I mean, I had a few things that were not. I didn't shout them out the window or anything, but would not be orthodox theology, but again, you know, the sacredness of finding in the moments of time that we have. If I could illustrate that real briefly, when I was in the parish, at one point I decided to join the Navy. My wife was really thrilled with this. And I went off to Newport, Rhode Island, where I went to school. And the thing I'll always remember is after about 2 weeks there, we began to realize that since we were commissioned officers and chaplains already, that they weren't really going to beat up on us. In fact, they gave us every evening off and all weekend. So this was not Marine Corps boot camp. I came to realize that. And some of us started to go out to dinner every night. And after about 3 weeks of it, you know, we'd go out, we'd have dinner, go over to Newport Creamery and get ice cream. You know, you've been there? It is the most incredible ice cream. If you ever go to Newport, Rhode Island, go to Newport Creamery. And one night I decided I wasn't going to go, and I just went out to this little jet of rocks out in this bay. And went out there with my Bible, and it was something I had not done for years. Frankly, I didn't do it in seminary. But I went out and I started reading Ecclesiastes 3, still one of my favorite texts, I've already mentioned it before. And that became a very formative moment, because I began to understand something about the Old Testament that I hadn't understood before. And that is that God does fill that moment, and that He is present. The problem isn't in His presence. The problem is in our sinful unwillingness to acknowledge His presence and to see those things, the guy cutting you off in the parking lot or whatever, as a moment that does belong to God. Now, in Hebrew thought, in the Old Testament, all moments belong to God. The very cycles of life belong to God. Not just in the agricultural festival, but in their personal lives, it belonged to God. The rite of circumcision is given. On the eighth day, the child is to be circumcised. You know, time itself, there's this continuum in which the child is brought into the covenant, into the people of God. But it's all done within time. Morning and evening and noontime are all filled with the thought of God. Ideally, which I don't know if any of us are really capable of, it's not just a matter of finding moments of praying the hours or something like a medieval monk, although that's well and good. But in recognizing each of those moments, the presence of the one who calls us into being as He called ancient Israel. I don't know if that, does that help or clarify anything at all? Yes.
Could you explain the what it means to the Old Testament Jews in their worship when the sacred objects, and you talk about the tongue, the face, when the sacred objects were taken away before? Of course, I'm referring to the Holy Spirit, all these things that they were about to do. What happened? What was your
Yeah, it was, let's look at, for my check for reference, Ezekiel. Ezekiel, I think it's like chapter 44. Instead, let's go somewhere else to change my mind on that. Let's go to 2 Kings. It's a better one. 2 Kings 25. Okay, this 2 Kings 25, and it's paralleled off from 2 Chronicles, deals with the destruction of the temple. About verse 13. Well, in verse 8, in the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and it describes the coming to Jerusalem. And in verse 13, in the pillars of bronze that were in the house of the Lord, and the stands in the bronze sea that were in the house of the Lord, the Chaldeans broke in pieces and carried the bronze to Babylon. And they took away the pots and the shovels and the snuffers and the dishes for incense and all the vessels of bronze used in the temple service. fire pans also in the bowls. What was of gold, the captain of the guard took away his gold, and what was of silver, silver. As for the two pillars, the one sea and the stands which Solomon had made for the house of the Lord, the bronze of all these vessels was beyond weight. The height of one pillar was 18 cubits, and upon it was a capital of bronze. The height of the capital was 3 cubits, and network of pomegranates, all of bronze, and upon the capital round about, and the second pillar and the like with the network. The effect of all this upon the people was, as it had also been at the time of Rehoboam. Okay, let's go to that too. We'll read it. That's 2 Chronicles, about chapter 12. In verse 9, the 2 Chronicles 12, so Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem. He took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He took away everything. He also took away the shields of gold which Solomon made, and King Rehoboam made in their stead shields of bronze and committed them to the hands of the officers of the guard who kept the door of the king's house. In both those places, we see an invasion and the sacking of the temple. In Rehoboam's case, Rehoboam was the son of Solomon. If you remember, the kingdom was divided at the death of Solomon. David ruled the unified the kingdom, actually. Solomon's son then ruled. After Solomon's death, Rehoboam took the throne. But as the story in 2 Chronicles has it, Rehoboam was young. And instead of listening to the old and wise advisors that were there in the court, he listened to his drinking buddies. And his drinking buddies told him to kind of crush down the northern tribe, treat them roughly. The wise advisors said, no, don't. Because he listened to his drinking buddies, he pressured the north, and the north rebelled. And then we have the division of the kingdom. Rehoboam is not that great of a king. And as punishment, God allows Shishak, the Egyptian emperor Shoshanik, actually was his name, in the Egyptian records, Shishak or Shoshanik, invades Jerusalem and takes away the treasures of the temple. The reaction of the people, of any people, when their temple is invaded, is that the house of God has been desecrated. Because that it was sacred and holy. Later, between the Testaments, there's at least one incident where one of the Greek rulers, there was a period of time in which Palestine was ruled by the Greeks, invaded or took the house of the Lord and sacrificed pigs on the altar, which was absolutely devastating. Particularly with, because of the Old Testament. I mean, he chose the pig rather than a sheep or something, precisely to offend. I don't know if that gets to your question at all.
Well,
first I would say that not all, a lot of times we Christians view Judaism as, you know, being looking for a Messiah to come. The fact is that most Jews do not. The messianic hope in Judaism is very subdued and has been for since 200 in it, or 135 in the defeat of Bar Kokhba. It's still there in some elements of Judaism. But for example, when the modern state of Israel was refounded in the 40s, there were and still are Jewish communities which refused to recognize it. Those are the actual Messianic Jewish communities who, as part and parcel of their worldview, believe that before Israel can be reestablished as a nation, Messiah must first come and establish Israel. But most Jews today, you know, if you were to mention Messiah, it's a meaningless term to them. I don't know if there is some movement among some actually more fundamentalist Christians to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, something they talked about ever since the modern state of Israel was founded. That's actually not something that is discussed in Jewish communities quite as much as it is in fundamentalist Christian communities, which is kind of interesting. To those who would be claim to be Christian and yet want to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, I think I'd have to raise some pretty fundamental Christian questions, like, if you want to rebuild a temple where there's going to be animal sacrifices, then do you really believe in Jesus as the sacrifice? You know, either he is it or there's nothing at all. But I'm not sure really that we can look at Judaism today and see that much of a messianism. Yeah. You see, in the time of Jesus, traditionally we tried or described Judaism in the first century. Okay, and even the centuries just before that, the time between the Testament, between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and that first century, as being this big monolithic thing, where, you know, everybody, all Jews believed the same thing. And all Jews did this, they all did that. Well, that's really a false picture of Judaism at that time. In fact, in the New Testament, you remember, you read about people like the Pharisees, and the Sadducees, and the Zealots, Essenes, perhaps the Qumran or Dead Sea Scroll community was guessing something. They used to say they were probably monks, but then they found female skeletons, so that kind of blew that theory. Actually, the guy who came up with that theory was a monk. But that whole period of time, what Judaism is, it's a bunch of little denominations. We know from the New Testament, that's the best source there is for the first century of Judaism. Jewish scholars recognize that too. We don't have that much literature from the first century except for the New Testament, where all these different groups are named. But if you recall, in the date 70 AD, when the temple was destroyed, all these groups in one way or the other related in some way to the temple and to the whole thing of sacred space, sacred time, sacred personnel, sacred objects, the sacrifice. But with the temple gone, only those groups whose whole philosophy and, if you will, theology, although they would never identify it as that, could exist without the temple, could survive its destruction. In other words, when the temple's destroyed, groups that you read about in the New Testament, like the chief priests, they've got nowhere to go. You know, their temple's gone. Other groups, like the Sadducees, had a very strong pull towards the temple. They disappear after 70. Who survives basically are two groups. One is the Pharisees, because their religious system had already begun the process of transferring the sacredness of the temple into its mirror reflection on the life of the community. And so they could continue on even though the temple had been destroyed. The other group that survives, the Pharisees, the other group that survives are what we might call apocalyptic or eschatological. These were the folks who were looking for the end of the world to come. They survive because the destruction of the temple means to them that the end of the world is coming. But then the apocalyptic Jews begin to place all their faith in Bar Kokhba. Remember we talked about him, the guy who had the big revolt in 135? So when he's wiped out, So is apocalyptic Judaism. And the only thing that's left after 135 are the Pharisees. Exactly. The Pharisees in about the year 200 AD formulate Mishnah. Mishnah becomes the basis of two sets of books called Talmud, Talmudic Judaism, Rabbinic Judaism. That is normative Judaism. That's becomes the standard Judaism. Now, in the last 50 years or so, Judaism has again begun to splinter. There's different forms of Rabbinic Judaism. For example, there's Orthodox Judaism. And some sects of that, the Hasidim. You've seen pictures of Hasidim in New York. You know, they wear the black robes and it's actually a Polish pietistic movement from the 17th century. But they're Orthodox Jews. There's also conservative Jews and reformed Jews. There's also a bunch of other groups now, Reconstructionist and some others. There's that as Lutherans. I mean, you think we're confused. Judaism is even more confused. But that's something, again, about the last 50, maybe it's last century, where now Judaism has become much as it was way back here, the time of Christ. But to identify in this whole thing, you know, who was looking for Messiah, it's all very difficult, just as it is today to say that Jews today would look for Messiah.
And one more question here. I understand that since the sacred army has just been destroyed, it seems their wishes lie so radically. The last question that I would like to answer, and how can I word it properly? I don't think I can even word it properly. What I'm trying to say now, what's happening to them now? What is their attitude with that kind and sacrifice once more? Could you just zero in on that?
You mean contemporary Judaism or ancient Judaism?
The contemporary Judaism. In comparison to the ancient ones, obviously the sacred objects have totally destroyed all those things.
And again, I can only speak in generalities of different groupings of Jews today. For some Jews, there is no sense of life beyond the grave. There is no resurrection. Others anticipate that. Now, the reason that's important is how one views the ultimate question of death says a lot about how one then can structure life. If the grave is all there is, then finally life itself can either be meaningless cycles, or you can still invest some form of meaning. But that meaning does not go on with your own life. For all Judaism, there is a very strong, that is religious Jews. There's also what we might call secular Jews, who are ethnically Jewish, but really don't have any thought or practice of their faith. But for religious Jews, even if they do not accept a resurrection or life after death, the cycles of life become the meaning, so that things like the circumcision of the child becomes a big festival. Death becomes a festival. A wedding becomes a festival. And because that's all you've got.
Would you say God probably did or destroy all that destroy that human view, so the acceptance of Christianity would be much easier and more acceptable?
Yeah, well, even more than that, I mean, the destruction of the temple?
Yeah, I mean, the sacred objects.
Exactly.
I understand now that once the sacred objects were destroyed, it destroyed practically their existence, their worship and existence, their belief.
Okay.
And you explain it, which is very, I understand it perfectly now.
Yeah.
But my question would be, why is it still so difficult for the Jews then to accept Christianity?
I'm not sure I can answer that. It is true, I think, in my experience, and I do have some familial connections here, that it is very difficult for to evangelize in a Jewish community. If you're a Christian. There are some explanations that are given. I'm not sure any totally explain that particular phenomenon. But I think a large part of it is, whereas the general culture around us, non-Christian culture around us, perhaps Christianity is ridiculed or but not thought of at all. And so it's not as difficult for a Christian to speak to somebody who is raised in a secular environment as opposed to somebody who's raised in a Jewish environment where one defining reality of life is that the Christians are to be avoided. In other words, in any kind of a religious Jewish community, Christianity and Christians, you can interact with them in business. But you have nothing further to do with them. There's a lot of Jews today who would ignore all that. You know, I actually have some friends that are Jewish, and they don't seem to be bothered by the fact that I'm Christian. But there's a certain antipathy towards Christians. And I think that, when you're raised in that kind of environment, it's very difficult to hear what a Christian is saying in matters of religion and faith. One explanation that is, I think, very difficult to deal with, but has quite a bit to say, is at the crucifixion of Jesus, where the Jewish response to Pilate was, "Let his blood be upon us and upon our children." Unfortunately, when I'm very hesitant in bringing that up, but it's there in Scripture, and I'm hesitant because it has also been used for some horrible persecution of Jewish people over the last 2,000 years. Yeah. Where Christians have done rather unchristian things.
Thank you very much.
Reverend Lang.
On a matter of a sacred object, again, you observed before that these objects are not God in those objects, but they remind or direct the minds of the people to that. And didn't say, but I guess the next step would be to say that is really a notable difference from animism or what the children of Israel did when they constructed the golden calf. That idolatry, gross idolatry, always, you know, invest that with godly power, I think you could say that.
Mm-hmm.
But, and the part that struck me then was that the reaction of Islam, which will not even permit any kind of image, even a photograph, they don't want you to take a picture, let alone ever construct an image or art. It's got to be geometric figures in one thing or another. Because I think the idea is you cannot have an image without it being an idol, you know. And I never thought about it when we traveled in Islamic countries and had that cultural thing and religious thing impressed upon us. I didn't think of it at the time that God did exactly that. He had these objects prescribed. And yet they had a totally different place.
Exactly.
And
yeah. Even. Yeah. And Islam, of course, rises in the Arabian desert, where idol worship was quite common. And the prohibitions that one finds in Quran, or other early Islamic literature, against any kind of image, arises, I think, from that context where early Islam is separating itself from the native religions. early Islam, or Islam had great problems in North Africa. Remember, North Africa was Christian in the first throughout the first three or four centuries of this era. In fact, men like saints like Saint Monica and her son, Saint Augustine, Saint Clement of Alexandria, many of the North African saints were in all likely black believers. North Africa was a black population. It was pushed south by the Islamic invasions. North Africa is now populated, has been populated since the Islamic invasions by people of primarily of Arabic descent. But as they came into North Africa and also up into Asia Minor, and eventually with the Ottoman Empire, all the way into Europe, right, into Austria, in Luther's great hymn, Lord, keep us steadfast in thy work, restrain the murderous Pope and Turk. Then 41, it used to be sung that way until the 41 hymnal, until TLH. They changed it in TLH. But Luther was, you know, just kind of looking over the mountains, and there's the Turk. I mean, they were pushing up. This is very real. But as Islam moves into Christianized area early on into North Africa, and either kills or pushes back the native population to the south, or forcibly converts them, they run into what are already Christian sanctuaries with things like altars and crosses and other things that are associated in the Arab mind with native Arab religion, which Islam had put down in that part of the world, and now they're going to put it down here. A really interesting time of history. In that part of the world. Our liturgies, by the way, are very closely related to North African liturgies. When anybody tells you that the liturgies we use are German, black Christians in North Africa were using those liturgies while our German ancestors, those of us who might be German, were out trying to find oak trees to sacrifice people to. There were people in Africa worshiping the true God, using the words that we use today. It's their liturgies. We're the foreigners to this.
All this about sacramental and incarnational theology of God creating time and space, and thinking about how extraordinarily vivid the Old Testament worship was, the temple and the sacrifices and all that stuff, it kind of begs the question, if we as Lutherans have a higher sacramental incarnational, or at least as high view, as anyone else, if we have the true view, we see Christ, then why do we treat the body of Christ and our worship like a, you know, like a plate of cheeses?
Well, you get a good question. I would stand to be corrected particularly by Dean Roening, who is personally knew Luther, I understand. But
I have a direct line to tell him.
Direct line?
Yes,
direct line. But Luther's own respect for the elements was quite extraordinary. There's one story, and I'm not sure if it's legend or truth, Dean Roening could probably tell us, that it's later in his life he spilled some wine, and his response was to lay down to lick it up. Is that a true story?
True story. At his ordination.
It was later in his life. Is that his ordination? Okay. That kind of piety towards those elements. Today we do see exactly what you described in more and more Lutheran circles, where the elements are treated, and all the sacred objects are kind of treated as if they were that their sacred character were secondary. I always find it dismaying, and I probably shouldn't say this because maybe you do it here. I don't know. The plastic communion cups, yeah, shot glasses. Do you use those here? No. They're glass? Okay. I prefer the common cup. I call the other shot glasses. I don't mean to be disrespectful to them, but Jesus used one cup. I'm a purist with that. But, you know, some churches use little disposable plastic ones. And I've actually seen it happen in Lutheran churches where after, what they do is they, in fact, the church that we attend does this, and I've been fighting this battle for 5 years. I'm just about to win it, too, to get rid of those things. I hope I am. But after communion, what they'll do is they'll take the cup, and then they kind of put it in a little plastic or a little wicker basket with a plastic liner, and then they're gathered up and just pitched. And no, this, you know, this is wrong. Ladies' Aid likes it that way because it's easy to clean up. Yeah, thank you. That's what I say too. That's what my wife says. but that attitude is prevalent anymore. And it's one that we need to combat, because there is the sacredness. There is a sacred character. There's debates theologically about, among even confessional Lutherans, two positions which broadly defined, and this isn't really fair to everybody, is, the consecrationist versus the receptionist. Is it at the words of institution where the body and blood of Christ become a reality, or is it when you receive it that it becomes a reality? You will find Orthodox confessional Lutherans arguing the point on either side, to be honest with you. It's not something that's ever really been resolved. But regardless, even if one is a strict receptionist that says it's only when you receive it that the body and blood of Christ is actually present, not before, not after, nonetheless, that bread and wine retains a sacred character. I don't take that view. I take the consecrationist.
So why should it be called, and I'm not trying to cause a stir here, why should it be called a consecrated Jesus when that glass is set down, that we know what came from that and what will come from that in 2 more weeks?
Or next week, hopefully.
Well, every week.
Yeah, so the Lutheran standard is every week.
It's true, yeah.
The use of common cup or individual cup doesn't have anything to do with the validity of the sacrament. My opposition is always to the use of the throwaway disposable cups. And I am, to a great extent, strongly in favor of the use of the common cup.
You say one.
Yeah, the one cup. That is not common in many of our churches. And it doesn't affect the validity of the sacrament. It can be done either way. But if I were to express a preference, my preference would very strongly be towards the chalice, the common cup, and not to the individual cup. I'm not sure what percentage of our churches use the individual cups. Probably most. I would say most do. And that's not a big theological problem at all. I mean, it's the Lord's Supper still. But it's important what happens with those cups. Yeah. Also, if it's a common cup, the disposal of extra wine, there are certain ways in which it's done. If there are individual cups, the same respect needs to be accorded to those cups and to the wine that might be remaining in them. Okay, it's where they begin to be just kind of, throw it away, pour it down the sink, or. Yeah, ultimately it is. Yeah, because you reuse them, but also the way in which they're washed and what happens to the water they're washed in, because that water is going to have the consecrated wine once you wash them. And it is important that we, I think, maintain a sense of sacredness of the object. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, it's, I always advocate the common cup, but not at the expense of saying, that the individual cups are in and of themselves wrong. Who uses
the disposable as opposed to the glass? I don't want.
Oh, yeah, no. The congregation I attend uses disposable cups.
And you're trying to do away with it.
I've been arguing this point for 5 years. I haven't won yet. I've been arguing a lot of points for 5 years. But I like in the Old Testament, you look for God's victory coming down the road.